The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What finally forced you to acknowledge your mental illness and ask for help?
The persistent and horrible voice in my head that kept telling me to kill myself, that is what convinced me I needed help. That's when I asked for help.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Jessie Close about her memoir titled Resilience, Two Sisters and a Story of Mental Illness. If readers are looking for an exciting memoir, this is certainly it. You've had what we call a colorful life. The title of the first chapter in Resilience is Not Your Normal Childhood. Explain why your childhood wasn't normal.
Well, first of all, when I was 1 year old, my parents joined a group called Moral Rearmament, and that took us away from our home, our ancestral home, and our parents were whisked away from us to do missionary work, and we were left in different homes with Moral Rearmament nannies. And that was the beginning of a total lack of family life.
And you have brothers and sisters.
I do. Two sisters and one brother.
According to your book, several factors likely delayed your diagnosis and treatment. First of all, you saw yourself as the problem child in your family for various reasons, which we'll talk more about. You were a very attractive young woman with a trust fund income, which may have attracted a couple of bad husbands, and you used drugs and alcohol. Even so, your own father, who was a doctor, didn't recognize your mental illness. Say a little bit about why that happened.
Well, Dad was a surgeon, and he was very nervous about anything to do with mental health. He didn't understand mental health. He didn't seek to understand mental health. Dad's whole philosophy was very New England, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
And because you weren't wildly successful in the world as a young woman, you were still struggling in a bad marriage, then you feel like he maybe wasn't paying attention a little bit too?
Oh, no. He was completely immersed in his own life.
One of the really amazing things that happened to you was when you were in Los Angeles, you and your first husband started a radio station.
Yeah.
That sounded like an incredibly chaotic but wonderful experience in a way.
Yeah, it was in a way.
How did that happen?
Well, my husband at the time was brutal, but he was also a genius. And he, at 19 years old, built a whole studio from scratch. We'd go to the electronics store and he'd pick out different diodes and transistors and metal fronts that he'd drill for knobs. And this was in the days of knobs instead of sliders. And he built the whole thing, and then it was like, okay, now what are we going to do? So we were, we tended to think of ourselves as revolutionaries. We decided to start broadcasting. So he went back to the electronics store and found a transmitter that had been used in Vietnam. So that seemed very apropos. And we hooked it up, and he put the antenna on top of our apartment building and started broadcasting. And 3 days later, the FCC came in and shut us down. But it was a pretty wonderful experience.
And you had famous people on the station, and you interacted
yeah.
with them.
Well, most of those people came when we were legal. He recognized the fact that there were no cable radio stations except on some campuses. There were no commercial cable radio stations, and we were just down the road from Theta Cable in L.A. So they gave us an experimental contract, and it worked. We were able to get a lot of artists into our studio, and the record companies began sending us their wares. We had a huge record collection, a vinyl collection, which I'm afraid I walked out on in the end. But yeah, it was cool. Hoyt Axton, who I was very disappointed to hear that he'd already passed when I discovered that he lived in Montana. And he was one of my favorite celebrities who showed up.
As you mentioned, your husband was brutal, and so you left that relationship and you went back to the East Coast. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that's where you experienced your first hallucination. It happened in an apartment in Washington, D.C., and this is the 1970s. You were still in your 20s. Describe that moment.
I was living in a tiny, dark apartment, which I'm sure lent itself to mental illness. There were bars on the windows and a tiny little kitchen, and I had a desk. When I was sitting at the desk, my back was to my bed. And at one point, my scalp started prickling, and I slowly turned and found myself sitting on my bed with my long hair hanging down, and it was a hallucination of myself, and it terrified me. This sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it terrified me to the point where I wasn't able to leave the apartment after that. I was scared to go outside the door. And this is something that's plagued me my whole life, being afraid to leave a place that I am comfortable in.
You turned around and saw yourself sitting on the bed when you were on the chair.
Yeah.
What's your official diagnosis?
My official diagnosis is bipolar 1 with psychotic tendencies, and I also tend to rapid cycling. Rapid cycling means you go back and forth between mania and depression very, very quickly. It's horribly, what would you say, destructive. It's very scary for people around you because they don't know what you're doing. Going from being high with lots of energy to low and depressed. I know when I was on the upswing, I could be very mean. And then I would fall back down into depression and feel great remorse and horror at what I had just done, but I wasn't able to stop it. I also tend towards, what's it called?
Let me look it up. Hold on. Mixed state?
Mixed state. Thank you. How did you find that so fast?
Oh, I bend and mark up my books.
Yeah, a mixed state is a scary place because that's when if you tend to suicide as I do, that's where you are when you really begin obsessing on killing yourself. A mixed state is depression with the energy of mania, which you need to kill yourself. So that's a very dangerous and dark place to be.
Well, you found out that your mental illness is genetic, which we'll talk more about shortly, and that you passed it on to your son, Kalen. And you also wrote about the reaction of a grocery store clerk when you told her that he'd been admitted to a hospital for treatment. Describe that situation for us.
Well, You know those little cups that you can put money into at the grocery checkout? Most of them are for multiple sclerosis or other physical disabilities. I remember telling the woman that my son had just been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a cup there that said, "Help Kalen, he's been diagnosed with schizophrenia." I mean, it seems so ridiculous to even think that, because it would be an interesting experiment, actually, to see what people's reaction would be. But her reaction to me telling her that my son had been diagnosed with schizophrenia was one of horror, and she just shut down.
She refused to talk with you about it or offer a gee, I'm sorry, or anything.
Yeah, no.
And after your diagnosis, which happened, what, about 3 or 4 years later?
Well, let's see, 2004. Yeah, you're right.
You had to deal with the ignorant reactions of people as well, some of whom accused you of faking it. And in your book, you asked the question, what is it about mental illness that makes people suspect you're faking it to get sympathy? Did you find an answer to that question?
I think the answer is because you look completely normal. I think I used an example of getting on the airplane when I had to take Kalen back to the hospital. And I realized that if he was in a wheelchair, everyone would be there helping him. The airline did give us a medical ticket. But, you know, unless you really looked at his eyes, which were scary, you wouldn't know that there was anything wrong with this young man. He was a good-looking young man, and he held it together very well on that trip.
You were taking him on a plane trip to go for treatment at McLean Hospital.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Jessie Close is here, and we're talking about her memoir, Resilience, Two Sisters and a Story of Mental Illness. Jessie's sister is the actress Glenn Close, and after a short break, we'll talk about how the nonprofit organization Glenn started is spreading awareness of the misconceptions about mental illness. If you'd like to hear this program again or share it with a friend, there's audio posted at The Right Question blog, mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. There was an incident recently in which a police officer in Deer Lodge shot and killed a suicidal man. What do you know about how police officers are handling mental illness these days?
Well, I know that the chief of police in Bozeman is very well versed in mental illness, and I went to the opening of the Gallatin Valley Mental Health Center, and the police were there. And they had a lot to do with getting that center going. They did not like having to handcuff someone with mental illness and take them all the way to Missoula or Helena or Billings. It was a nightmare for those guys and women. But I know the police in Bozeman have had special training in mental illness, and that the police chief himself travels and speaks about this.
You wrote about participating in research that identified a specific genetic link to your mental illness and to Kaylin's. And I'd like you to read a passage that explains how that happened. But before you do, I'll just say that you call your house in Montana the Mouse House.
When I heard the news, I laughed. Dr. Deborah Levy, the director of McLean Hospital's Psychology Research Laboratory, called to tell me there was a mouse scampering around in a laboratory that had been designed to replicate genes found inside Kaylin and me. I'm not only living in my mouse house, I've also helped create a close family mouse. The story of how my family got our own genetically engineered mouse begins when Kaylin first arrived at McLean Hospital in 2002 and agreed to donate blood as part of a research project. During a genetic analysis of his blood years later, doctors discovered that one of his genes had an intriguing mutation. Instead of having two copies of certain genes, which was what most people had, Kaylin had four copies. More important, one of the genes with four copies was not just any gene. It was one that scientists suspected could play a role in mental disorders. Dr. Levy had spent much of her career searching for genetic links that could help explain the origins of schizophrenia. Energetic and brilliant, she is not only a researcher, but also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. She called Kaylin and asked whether he would undergo more tests and whether he would give her his permission to contact other members of the close family about donating a blood sample for her research. She was especially interested in my blood because I also had been diagnosed with a mental illness. Everyone agreed to participate. My children, my siblings, Tom, Kaylin's father, and my parents. Dad was still alive at the time. When the genetic results were analyzed, they revealed two things. First, I was definitely the daughter of Bill and Bettine Close, which automatically disqualified me from appearing on one of those awful Guess Who's the Father tabloid television shows. Dr. Levy and her research team also discovered that Tom and eight members of the Close family had the correct number of genes, but Kaylin and I did not. We had the exact same mutation, which meant that I had passed it to him. Dr. Levy said this discovery was important because one of the mutated genes is the gene that codes for an enzyme called glycine decarboxylase, or GLDC, which breaks down glycine. Having extra copies of this gene could cause glycine to break down faster than it does in other people's brains. Without enough glycine, an important brain receptor known as the NMDA receptor won't function normally. Neuroscientists believe that a malfunctioning NMDA receptor is associated with psychosis, especially schizophrenia. Dr. Levy and her team assured me that our mutated gene could be a smoking gun when it comes to figuring out the underlying causes of our mental illnesses. This is because no one really understands the genetic underpinnings of serious mental illnesses. Doctors rely on clinical assessments of the symptoms they observe and have to decide if an individual has schizophrenia, a mood disorder such as bipolar disorder, a smattering of both, as in schizoaffective disorder, or severe depression. Finding an intriguing errant gene could be the first step in understanding the biology of mental illness and, many researchers hope, eventually finding a cure. Dr. Levy asked whether Kaylin and I would be willing to undergo additional tests if she could get funding for research from the National Institute of Mental Health. We said yes, and after several years and endless paperwork, Dr. Levy finally got the green light. 10 years after Kalen first donated his blood at McLean, we were about to become guinea pigs.
And so you're guinea pigs for the rest of your lives?
Probably. Yeah, probably. Yeah, we take glycine. Yeah, Kalen and his control was Sander, my other son, and Maddie, my daughter, was my control. And we all went, we had many, many MRIs. The worst one was a 3-hour one that we each had to endure. And after an hour and a half, we were pulled out and given a lot of glycine, which seems to help propel normalcy. I'm not sure. I know when I am not on glycine, I don't feel as good as I do when I'm on it, which is pretty amazing. We've had trial after trial with this, and there's no doubt anymore that this really, really helps.
You asked your sister, who is the actress Glenn Close, to do something about the stigma of people with mental illness. Tell us what she did and how you've been able to participate.
Well, what she did is she's a very thorough person and does not go out there unless she knows what she's talking about. So she went to a place in New York where she lives called Fountain House, which is one of the oldest daily living places for people with mental illness. They don't spend the night there, but they have amazing programs. My favorite one is two or three people with mental illness will share a job, which I just love that idea. So between the two or three of them, they would cover a 40-hour week at a certain job. So she went there. She ended up being in the flower arrangement room with mentally ill people who were working there. And under their illnesses, she began to see their humanity. And after she was there for a few weeks, she felt that she had learned enough to actually go ahead and start talking about launching some kind of organization, which has ended up to be our organization that's called Bring Change to Mind. That's numeral 2, mind. We have a website. There's an annual gala in New York to help raise money. The first thing that she did is she called Ron Howard, the director, and talked to him about doing a public service announcement. Then she called Kalen and me and said, you know, I'm going to do this, but I'm not going to do this without you. So we all met at Grand Central Station, and we had T-shirts on that said, sister bipolar, cousin schizophrenia, battle buddy, depression, all, you know, the whole gamut of mental illnesses. For instance, my T-shirt said bipolar. My daughter Maddie's T-shirt said daughter. So it was a very visible way of letting people know that we walk among you. The public service announcement has run a lot. Have you ever seen it?
I have,
that
yes.
One?
It was very well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at the end, Glennie and I, our T-shirts just turned to colors to get across the fact that, you know, we do walk among you. Supposedly 1 in 4 people suffer from some kind of mental illness. So you can be sure if you're in a station like Grand Central Station in New York that you're walking past many, many people who are suffering with some kind of mental illness. I think one of the most important things to remember is that it is a physical situation. there are many people who don't, quote, believe, unquote, in mental illness. There really is nothing to believe in. It just is. I get upset with people who say, oh, you shouldn't take that medication. And all I can say is, you should have known me before. You should have known me before I was medicated. I was out of control. And I have a really wonderful life now. I have a granddaughter, and my life is good.
You've been sober and medicated for a while now, but in your book, you wrote about missing your old self, your wild, manic self. And obviously, you don't still feel that way all the time. You don't want the repercussions, but I think you miss some of that aliveness, yes?
I do. Yeah, I do. I do, but less and less. I mean, I don't know what I would do with it now. I have a really wonderful life, and it's because I was diagnosed properly and because I'm on the right medication that I can live a full life. And I don't regret that at all. The time when wishing I was manic again, when that comes over me, that's usually happens at night. Because if I didn't use medication, I probably would never sleep. And the nighttime activity is something I will probably always miss. I used to love staying up very late and drawing or writing or drinking, or, you know, it was an alone time that was very creative and wonderful.
Your relationships are probably also a lot more stable.
Yeah, to say the least.
They have to be, yeah. Because I don't think you could physically live through another couple decades of what you wrote about in this book.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I live with four little dogs now. They're all I want to deal with.
And visits from the grandkid.
Yeah. Yeah, my children have been so supportive and wonderful. I mean, for Sander and Maddie to go through what they had to go through on those MRIs and everything, it took a lot of dedication on their part. Maddie has, because she was more exposed to my moods than the boys were, simply because she was little when I was in real trouble with my moods, she kind of has an instinctual ability to track anything psychiatric. So I'm hoping she'll go into that field because she's pretty amazing.
Jessie Close lives in the Bozeman, Montana area. You can find out more about her and listen to this program again online at mtpr.org/twq, or use the link on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.